Okay, let's pick up where we left off in 1 Kings. We left off in chapter 11. We're just going to get right into it because we're running a little bit behind tonight. But beginning with verse 1 of chapter 11, it says, "Now King Solomon loved many foreign women, along with the daughter of Pharaoh, Moabite, Ammonite, Edomite, Sidonian, and Hittite women, from the nations concerning which the Lord had said to the sons of Israel, 'You shall not associate with them, neither shall you associate with you, for they will surely turn your heart away after other gods.' Solomon held fast to these in love, and he had 700 wives, princesses, and 300 concubines, and his wives turned his heart away." Now, before we get any much further into this, in that verse 2, I just want to say something in passing. It says here that the nations concerning which the Lord had said to the sons of Israel, "You shall not associate with them, neither shall you associate with you, for they will surely turn your heart away from, to other gods." You know, God gave specific prohibitions in the writings of Moses that they were not to intermarry with the heathen women. And he gave specific reasons why. And he told them right here, because they would turn their hearts away from the one true God. And I'll just say this in passing because it really irritates me. I mean, there was a number of years ago, there was an article in New York Times in an editorial where some guy was just saying that the Bible forbids interracial marriage and therefore the Bible was nothing but a hate book, and he was trying to put in his plug for homosexuality. Man, I just get so aggravated with that kind of stuff because here this guy, this editor of this paper, put this article in there and he's saying something that's totally false. Because God was not saying that you couldn't marry the foreigner. What he was really saying is that if they don't convert to Judaism, if they don't convert to the one true religion, if they don't turn their life over to me, then I don't want you intermarrying with them because they'll lead your heart astray. That's what the Bible says. It has nothing to say about interracial marriage. But you see how, you know, Satan will use things and use these people to run off in a totally different direction just to get people to who are ignoramuses, who know nothing about the scriptures, say, well, yeah, the Bible must be a hate book. But we read it right here that Solomon gets involved with all these foreign women, which God forbid his people to do, because if they are not converted to the one true God, then they're going to lead your heart astray. Anyway, that verse 4 says, "And it came about when Solomon was old, his wives turned his heart away after other gods, and his heart was not wholly devoted to the Lord his God, as the heart of David his father had been." And before we go over further too, that verse 4, it didn't say that Solomon did an about face here and all of a sudden he just didn't believe in the God of heaven. But what does it say? It says that these women turned his heart away and that he wasn't wholly devoted to the Lord. In other words, he still believed in the Lord, the God of heaven, but he was in a compromised position where now his relationship with God was compromised to the point where he just, to placate his wives, gave in to a lot of their idolatrous practices. And he was still trying to cling to the one true God. And there's a lot of people today that do exactly that. And once you go down that road, I mean, you have nothing because you have compromised your relationship with Christ. And that verse 5, it says, "So Solomon went after Ashtaroth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and after Milcom," and Milcom is another name for Moloch, "the detestable god of the Ammonites. And Solomon did what was evil in the sight of the Lord and did not follow the Lord fully as his father David had done. Then Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the detestable idol of Moab, on a mountain which is east of Jerusalem, and for Molech, the detestable idol of the sons of Ammon. Thus he did for all of his foreign wives who burned incense and sacrificed to their gods. Now God was angry with Solomon because his heart was turned away from the Lord, the God of Israel, who had appeared to him twice, and he commanded him concerning these things that he should not go after other gods, but he did not observe what the Lord had commanded. So the Lord said to Solomon, 'Because you have done this, and you have not kept my covenant and my statutes, which I have commanded you, I will surely tear the kingdom from you, and I will give it to your servant. Nevertheless, I will not do it in your days for the sake of your father David, but I will tear it out of the hand of your son. However, I will not tear away all the kingdom, but I will give one tribe to your son for the sake of my servant David and for the sake of Jerusalem, which I have chosen.'" Now, before we go any further, just, you know, looking at what I think, is very common knowledge as far as the number of wives that Solomon had. I mean, he had 700 wives. He had 300 concubines. And obviously, a number of these women that he married, especially the foreign women, had something to do with some kind of political alliance. And then when he would get into these political alliances with these other kings and these other kingdoms, he naturally would be in a position where he could get a significant amount of money in terms of dowry, in terms of tribute, in terms of taxes, this type of things. But I don't put the same kind of credence in the writings of Josephus as I do the Bible, because there's a number of things that I've read in the writings of Josephus that don't measure up to what the Bible says. But I think he gives kind of some interesting insights about Solomon, because Josephus writes about this same incident where he says, "But although Solomon was become the most glorious of kings and the best beloved by God and exceeded in wisdom and riches those that had been rulers of the Hebrews before him, yet did not he preserve in his happy state until he died. Nay, he forsook the observation of the laws of his father, and it came to an end no way suitable for a foregoing history of him. He grew mad in his love for women, and laid no restraint on himself in his lust. Nor was he satisfied with the women of his country alone, but he married many wives out of foreign nations." And then he goes on to say, "But Solomon was falling headlong into unreasonable pleasures, and regarded not those admonitions. For when he had married 700 wives and daughters of princesses and the eminent persons and 300 concubines, and these beside the king of Egypt's daughter, he soon was governed by them till he came to imitate their practices. He was forced to give them his demonstrations of his kindness and affection to them, to live according to the law of their countries. And he also grew in years, and his reason became weaker by the length of time, and it was not sufficient to recall to his mind the institutions of his own country, and he still more and more contempted his own God and continued to regard the gods that marriages had introduced him." Anyway, what that's basically saying is that Solomon, you know, he started out really well as a young man, as a young king. He really was wholly devoted to God. But then little incremental steps at a time, he kept marrying all these different women for all these different reasons. But one of the things that Josephus brings out, that the Bible doesn't bring out, that this guy became governed by his lust. I mean, he was just driven by a sexual appetite, that he wanted all this different variety. I'm sure he probably couldn't remember half his wives' names, you know. You know, but he had all these women, and I guess he was quite a sexual athlete. But it says here what happened was that his reasoning became weaker and weaker as he grew older and older, and his wisdom began to leave him, because it was kind of a judgment from God how they turned him. But it's interesting the way he pointed it out, that the women began to govern him. Here he was, the wisest man, who could see through so much, and yet he couldn't see through this. And I don't want to get off on a tangent here, but I've just told you, just the power of a woman in a man's life can be incredible, either for good or for evil. And you could see it time and time and time again. I've always considered Adam to probably be the most intelligent man that ever lived, because, you know, he came directly from the hand of God. There wasn't one flaw in him. I think his IQ would have been way off the charts. I mean, he named all the animals and all the creatures according to their, let's say, their attributes or characteristics. I mean, that was phenomenal. He's a walking dictionary. And the devil couldn't deceive him, because we were told that in Timothy. It wasn't the man that was deceived, that the woman, being quite deceived, fell into transgression. But the devil just knew. He figured, hey, I'm not going to be able to flim-flam this man or jerk him around, and he's not going to fall for my BS and my lies. But I think the woman is more gullible, and I could get to her. And once I get to her, you know, he's just going to fall like a dumb ox. Because the man, you know, sex is the greatest thing on this planet, and he just doesn't want to be without his little round cake or whatever you want to call him, man. So he's willing to disobey God. Well, that, you know, see the influence there? Same thing with Samson. I mean, the strongest man that ever lived. Same thing with Solomon, the wisest man. The same thing with, look at Elijah. He was the greatest of the prophets. He was afraid of no man. No man intimidated him, man. He stood up against 350 prophets of Baal, and then he had them killed. I mean, three times Ahab sent it pursuing armies after him. He called down fire from heaven twice and consumed them 50 men at a time. This guy just was not afraid of men. But then after he killed all of these false prophets, Jezebel set a contract out on his life, and he goes running scared. It's like he ran and ran and ran until he could run no more. He's absolutely exhausted. He just falls under a juniper tree and prays to die. I mean, you know, what is this about the woman? You look at David. He followed God with his whole heart, mind, soul, and strength. He was the greatest warrior that ever lived, the greatest king that ever lived in many respects. He sees a woman taking a bath, and he can't control himself. I mean, it's like
the shores of history are just strewn with the wreckage of men who have been overthrown by the beauty and the charm of a woman. But interesting thing, remember what God had said to Eve as part of her curse. And I think I brought this up before, but it goes right along, I think, with what we're reading tonight. When Adam and Eve had sinned, and then, of course, Adam got the curse on him, that the ground would be cursed because of him, and in the sweat of his brow he would earn his bread or eat his bread, and the ground would now be in such a cursed condition that thistles and thorns would grow. Well, to the woman he said, I will greatly multiply your pain in childbirth, and in pain you shall bring forth children, yet your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you. Now that's an interesting statement when it says that your desire shall be for your husband, but he shall rule over you. Because if you read what God had said to Cain, sin is crouching at the door, and its desire is for you, but you must master it. That's the same words that he's using, that the woman would have a desire for her husband as the way that a sin would desire to have Cain. In other words, the woman would want to control the man, but the man will rule all over the woman. Now, isn't that a formula for disaster? You got one who wants to control, and the other one is going to rule, and it's just going to be a knockdown, drag-out conflict. And you see a situation here with the women that Solomon had married, because they weren't committed to the Lord God of heaven, they were able to control him. And they basically brought him to ruin. You know, and that, of course, it's totally Solomon's fault. I'm not blaming the woman. I'm just pointing out the fact that look at the power that a woman has. When you look at Solomon's wisdom, that there wasn't a wiser man before him or after him, except for the Lord Jesus Christ. I would have just loved to have just asked him question after question. I mean, I really would have. And I would have been taking notes, man. And there's no doubt in my mind about it. I would just love to have had, you know, some of his insights, especially with dealing with so many of the buffoons that I got to deal with today. I mean, I just would like to have had his wisdom to deal with it. And anyway, you know, he just ends up shipwrecked at the end of his life. But he even goes as far as to placate his wives, and he makes these altars for, you know, these different gods. The one was the Ashtoreth, otherwise known as Astarte, and I think it's the same goddess of the Babylonians who was called Ishtar. It's the goddess of fertility. Nothing's changed. Thousands of years have come and gone, but we still have this Ashtoreth today. What is it? It's the goddess of sex. And how many people put sex above God, or, you know, they're willing to disobey God for the fleeting pleasures of the flesh in regards to fornication and adultery and homosexuality and any number of things that God has forbidden. Well, when you do that, you put this goddess before God. And he also had the god of Molech, or Malcom, which was the god of the Ammonites. And remember, Ammon was the son of an incestuous relationship between the younger daughter of Lot and this Molech. I mean, we are told in Leviticus 20, this is what God says about this particular god. In Leviticus 20, God says, you shall also say to the sons of Israel, any man from the sons of Israel or from the aliens sojourning in Israel who gives any of his offspring to Molech shall surely be put to death. The people of the land shall surely stone him with stones. He says, I will also set my face against that man and will cut him off from among his people because he has given some of his offspring to Molech, so as to defile my sanctuary and to profane my holy name. And then he just goes on about this god. But I'm saying, look what these people would do. This god of Molech or Malcom, it was the god of the Ammonites, they would literally have this statue of metal, of iron, of cast iron, of bronze, or whatever it is, in the shape of some form of god. And I've read situations where they would have his arms outstretched and they'd have a big fire before this god. And, you know, the idol itself would be in the fire, but what they would do is they would take their infant children and they would throw them into the arms of this Molech. They would sacrifice it to this god because they felt like, hey, this god, if you sacrifice your children to him, he's going to bless you with fertile crops and numerous children, and your cattle won't get disease, and you'll have plenty of herds and this type of thing. We have today, we don't call it the god of Molech. We don't call it the god of Malcolm, right? But how many children today are offered up on the altar of convenience? In other words, how many children are aborted today? We're pushing 50 million that have been murdered in their mother's womb. 97% to 99% of those children that have been murdered have been done out of convenience. It hasn't been done because of a rape or because of incest or because the child would be born handicapped. I really believe this. I believe with all my heart, if this country permitted abortions in only those circumstances, and only those circumstances, I don't believe that God would bring down the wrath that he's about to bring down upon us. You know what I'm saying? If it was only those three. But when you have 97 and 99% of these murders of these children that's done out of convenience, for material or monetary reasons or whatever, I mean, this child's just going to be an inconvenience to me and to my lifestyle and whatever. You see, that's no different than throwing your infant child to Moloch. It really isn't. You know, but people, of course, they don't see that. And, of course, offering up your children, sacrificing your children on the altar of, let's say, materialism, where you fail to raise up your children in love and knowledge and fear of God because you're too darn busy out there trying to make a buck and invest in all your stocks and your bonds or whatever else. You don't invest the time that God wants us to invest in our children. I mean, you know, God made it very plainly in Deuteronomy and in Numbers and other portions of Scripture that, hey, you're to talk about God and talk about His Word, talk about the things of God to your children when they wake up and when they're walking along the way and when you lay down at night, this type of thing. But how many parents do that because they're too involved with what? TV and material things? Thousands of years have come and gone and nothing's really changed but the name of the God. The God's still around. We've just changed His name. You can change the name from Moloch to materialism, for as far as I'm concerned. And you had the god of Chemosh, which was the god of Moab. And it was the same type of thing. People would offer their children unto this god. And so you see how far Solomon's falling. And to me, it's a dark warning that if Solomon could be so twisted around, there's no hope for anybody unless we really are totally committed to Christ and not going to give an inch and say, hey, you know, this is what Jesus meant when he said, hey, unless you hate your mother and your father and your brother and your sister and your wife and even yourself, you cannot be my disciple. He means, hey, man, you got to put me first. You know, you're not to hate anybody. But he's saying that our love for him must be supreme. And if we're going to start compromising like Solomon did, then we're only going to end up shipwrecked. Anyway, does anybody have anything you want to add or share before we move on here?
John, yeah. Did he have any concubines or wives from different tribes?
Yeah, he did have the one of the daughters of the king of Geshur, which was up there in the northern part of the eastern side of the Jordan. But I'm under the impression that the wives that he did have were converts. I mean, if they were foreign wives, they were converts to the one true God. There was nothing wrong with marrying a Canaanite woman as long as she converted to the true God. Because we even see that in Jesus. You look in Jesus' ancestry. What do we see? We see Ruth was a Moabitess. We see Rahab was a Canaanite. And they're in the direct line of Jesus Christ. But they committed to the one true God, see? So God doesn't have any problems with interracial marriage or any other such thing. That's just all bogus. It's all bunk. It's all by some buffoon who's trying to discredit the Bible. In the New Testament, God still has the same principle. He says, be not unequally yoked with unbelievers. He didn't say, don't be unequally yoked with a different race, did he? He's just saying unbelievers. That's what he's talking about here. And anyway, beginning with that, pick up that verse 11. So the Lord said to Solomon, because you have done this and you have not kept my covenant and my statutes which I have commanded you, I will surely tear the kingdom from you and I will give it to you, your servant. Now, we're going to read about this guy, the servant, in the next chapter. But here's the thing that I think is significant, is that, this is a prediction of the split of the kingdom. It'll become the northern tribes and the southern tribes. And we kind of have to get that straight in our mind, because when we get further and further into the first book of Kings, we're going to see that there's different kings that are mentioned all the time. If you understand in your mind that it's, that the kingdom has been split, so the king of the northern tribes, when it's talking about them, you can't confuse it with the king of the southern tribe. But this is where it all came about, because of this sin. And he says here in that verse 12, says, nevertheless, I will not do it in your days for the sake of your father David, but I will tear it out of the hand of your son. However, I will not tear it away all the kingdom, but I will give one tribe to your son for the sake of my servant David, for the sake of Jerusalem, which I have chosen. And, you know, God talked about how he would show loving kindness to 1,000 generations to those who love him. And because of David's, the legacy that he left in terms of his commitment to God, it still carried over to God, even though he was totally in the right to completely destroy David's kingdom. He wasn't about to do that for the sake of David, even though Solomon had so angered him. And then in verse 14 it says, then the Lord raised up an adversary to Solomon, Hadad, the Edomite. He was of the royal line of Edom. For it came about that when David was in Edom, and Joab, the commander of the army, had gone up to bury the slain, and had struck down every male in Edom, for Joab and all of Israel stayed there 6 months until he had cut off every male in Edom, and that Hadad fled to Egypt, he and a certain Edomites of his father's servants with him, while Hadad was a young boy. And they arose from Midian and came to Paran, and they took men with them from Paran and came to Egypt, to Pharaoh the king of Egypt, who gave him a house and assigned him food and gave him land. Now Hadad found great favor before Pharaoh, so that he gave him in marriage the sister of his own wife, the sister of Tahpenes, the queen. And the sister of Tahpenes bore his son Genubath, whom Tahpenes weaned in Pharaoh's house, and Genubath was in Pharaoh's house among the sons of Pharaoh. But when Hadad heard in Egypt that David slept with his fathers, and that Joab, the commander of the army, was dead, that Hadad said to Pharaoh, "Send me away that I may go to my own country." Then Pharaoh said to him, "But what have you lacked with me, that behold you are seeking to go to your own country?" And he answered, "Nothing, nevertheless you must surely let me go." Now, here's the thing. We don't know a whole lot about this Hadad, but apparently he was an Edomite that David was destroying these people as a judgment from God, and he and some other Edomites managed to escape. Now, what's interesting to me about this incident is this Hadad, when he's a young boy, he's able to escape from David. He goes to Egypt, and he somehow ingratiates himself to Pharaoh. He becomes such a privileged figure in Pharaoh's court that Pharaoh gives his sister-in-law in marriage to Hadad, and she bears him a child, Genubath, and the guy has got it made. He's got it made, but then he finds out, okay, well, David's dead and Joab is dead. But what's he want to do? He wants to come back and just wreak havoc with David's son Solomon and with Israel, because he's got a real grudge to bear. I mean, he's just full of malice. And you know what? I can't help but look around and look at the war on terror that we're up against today. A lot of what's happening today doesn't make a whole lot of sense to us as Americans. It really doesn't. Look at these guys that flew the planes into the Twin Towers, okay? I mean, a lot of them were educated. Some of them were educated here. A lot of them had money. They had wealth. They had everything going for them. A lot of them did, right? And you sit back and say, what the heck? What's the deal with these guys? But what's happening to us? Because we have forsaken God, God is just raising up adversaries against us, and we are knee-deep, or up to our eyeballs, rather, in this war on terror. And we are hated all over the world. When we forsake God, He forsakes us, and that what happens? Adversaries are raised up against us, just like what this Hadad did with Solomon. You know, Solomon was a man of peace. He had everything going for him, but because he began to forsake the Lord allows people like this, or raises up people like this, to become thorns in his side or cinders in his eyes or something, in the hopes, undoubtedly, to try to get the person to repent, try to get Solomon to come to his senses. But obviously it didn't work, and obviously it's not working with us, is it? But look what happened. Not only did he raise up Hadad, who had it made but left everything behind to become a terrorist. You know, look at that. And he said, look at that verse 23. God also raised up another adversary to him, Rezon, the son of Eleada, who had fled from his lord Hadadazar, the king of Zobah, and he gathered men to himself and became a leader of a marauding band. And after David slew them in Zobah, and they went to Damascus and stayed there and reigned in Damascus. So he was an adversary to Israel all the days of Solomon, along with the evil that Hadad did, and he abhorred Israel and reigned over Syria. Now, look at that. Even today, thousands of years later, there's just so much bad blood there, but this goes way back, right? But what happens here? This is another guy. What does he do? We're not told what he does, but apparently he's living in Damascus, which is the oldest city in history. And he's from Damascus, apparently launches a bunch of marauding raids into Israel, and he executes a number of terrorist acts against Israel and Solomon's kingdom. Now, isn't that what's happening to us? But are we listening? Just like Solomon, we just you know, in spite of all his wisdom, you know, he ends up shipwrecked, and we don't have his wisdom. Look at us. You know, we've got the elections coming up in a year, and you see all these politicians, and they're going at it and going at it, and I'm thinking, you know what? These buffoons, they don't get it. They just want to be captain of the Titanic. Go figure. Because they don't see where this is all headed. because we've forsaken God. What they really needed to do is show enough guts to stand up and say, you know what we need to do? We need to do what it says in 2 Chronicles 7. If my people will call by my name, will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, I will heal their land. Now, what politician is going to say that? Anyway, verse 26. And now it says he raises up another adversary. Look at this, verse 26. Then Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, the Ephraimite of Zerida, Solomon's servant, whose mother's name was Zerah, a widow, also rebelled against the king. Now, this was the reason he rebelled against King Solomon. Solomon built the Milo and closed up the breach of the city of his father David. Now, the man Jeroboam was a valiant warrior, and when Solomon saw that the young man was industrious, he appointed him over all the forced labor of the house of Joseph. And it came about at that time when Jeroboam went out of Jerusalem that the prophet Ahijah, the Shilohite, found him on the road. Now Ahijah clothed himself with a new cloak, and both of them were alone in the field. And Ahijah took hold of the new cloak which was on him, and he tore it into 12 pieces. And he said to Jeroboam, take for yourselves 10 pieces, for thus saith the Lord, the God of Israel, behold, I will tear the kingdom out of the hand of Solomon and give you 10 tribes, but he will have one tribe for the sake of my servant David and for the sake of Jerusalem, the city which I have chosen from all the tribes of Israel. Because they have forsaken me and have worshipped Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, Chemosh, the god of Moab, Malcolm, the god of the sons of Ammon, and they have not walked in my ways, doing what is right in my sight, and observing my statutes and my commandments, as his father David did. Nevertheless, I will not take the whole kingdom out of his hand, but I will make him ruler all the days of his life for the sake of my servant David, whom I chose, who observed my commandments and my statutes. But I will take away the kingdom from his son's hand and give it to you, even 10 tribes. So to his son, I will give one tribe, that my servant David may have a lamp always before me in Jerusalem, the city where I have chosen for myself to put my name. And I will take you, and you shall reign over whatever you desire, and you shall be king over Israel. Then it will be that if you listen to all that I command you, and walk in my ways, and do what is right in my sight, by observing my statutes and my commandments, as my servant David did, then I will be with you and build you an enduring house, as I built for David, and I will give Israel to you. Thus I will afflict the descendants of David for this, but not always. Solomon sought therefore to put Jeroboam to death, but Jeroboam arose and fled to Egypt to Shishak, the king of Egypt, and he was in Egypt until the death of Solomon. Now the rest of the acts of Solomon and whatever he did and his wisdom, are they not written in the book of the acts of Solomon? Thus the time of Solomon reigned in Jerusalem over Israel was 40 years, and Solomon slept with his fathers and was buried in the city of his father David, and his son Rehoboam reigned in his place. Now, just a couple of things before we conclude this chapter, which I think is kind of significant. Now you got this Jeroboam. He's an Ephraimite, and the prophet Ahijah goes to him, and he just basically has a new cloak on, a new jacket or garment on. He rips it into 12 pieces. I mean, that clothes in those days, you just don't go down to the Gap and buy a new one, man. I mean, it took a lot to make clothes, but he took this brand new cloak, tore it in 12 pieces, and he gave 10 to Jeroboam. Okay, he said that this is what God's going to do. He's going to give you the 10 tribes, and two are going to be kept for Solomon's son, for the sake of my son David, or my servant David. Now, here's what's kind of significant to me, is that a couple of things in mind before I forget to. If you look at the situation, there's always referred to as the 12 tribes of Israel. But remember, when they went into the Promised Land, there was no tribe of Joseph. What happened to Joseph? And when I say there was no tribe of Joseph, there was no tribe named Joseph. What happened to Joseph's descendants?
Split between the two youngest sons.
They were split. So in other words, Joseph had a double portion, a double inheritance. There was Ephraim and Manasseh. But when it keeps saying that he will give 10 tribes to the northern kingdoms and keep back one tribe, well, it actually ends up being two tribes. Just keep it in mind, because up north, there, instead of being the tribe of Joseph, there was a tribe of Ephraim and a tribe of Manasseh. And Judah became one with Benjamin. Okay, because I know it can be kind of confusing. I don't want to get that technical about it, but I'm sure if somebody is reading this, they'd say, well, I don't understand. How come it's just 10 and 1
make 11, what happens to the other tribe there? Well, that's what it's talking about here. But another thing that I think was kind of interesting as far as just some insights that I gleaned from the writings of Josephus, he talked about Jeroboam. He said he was elevated by these words of the prophet. In other words, it really went to his head. He got kind of puffed up at what Ahijah had told him. But Josephus says, and being a young man of warm temper and ambitions of greatness, he could not be quiet. In other words, Jeroboam, what he did is he started telling everybody what Ahijah said to him. Josephus says, and when he had so great a charge in the government and called to mind what had been revealed to him by Ahijah, he endeavored to persuade the people to forsake Solomon and to make a disturbance and to bring the government over to himself. But when Solomon understood his intention and treachery, he sought to catch him and kill him. But Jeroboam was informed of it beforehand, and he fled to Shishak in Egypt. So it just kind of gives you a little insight here, because we don't get this kind of detail as far as what's written here in this chapter 11 of 1 Kings. But that's what happened. It's like Jeroboam was a servant. He was over the forced labor that Solomon had, and he was a very industrious man, and he was a valiant warrior, and Solomon saw, hey, this guy's got a lot of potential. So he put him in charge of his forces there as far as the forced labor, and he really excelled. But then the guy, you know, when he heard what was going to happen, couldn't keep his mouth shut. He couldn't bide his time. Instead, he just started telling everybody, hey, the prophet told me I'm going to be king. And then so he tried to stir up a revolt. And when Solomon got word of it, he set a contract out on his life. Then he started running for his life, right? But interesting thing, too, but when God told Solomon he was going to tear the kingdom away from him and give it to his servant, and his servant was Jeroboam, right? So Solomon must have known this was probably going to happen. So Solomon tried to put an end to it, but of course it didn't work. So Jeroboam goes to Egypt, and then he finds out when Solomon's dead, then he comes back. But another interesting thing, it says that in that verse 41, the rest of the acts of Solomon and whatever he did and his wisdom, are they not written in the book of the acts of Solomon? Well, that's another lost book. Interesting thing. There's the book of Jasar, the book of Wars, the book of Solomon. I think there was a couple other books that are mentioned. As a matter of fact, there's actually a book of Corinthians is missing. But this is one of the books that we don't have today. But apparently it was a historical account of a number of things that Solomon did. I'd love to have read that book if it had other insights, especially since it says that Solomon wrote 3,000 Proverbs. We only have a fraction of what he wrote. It says he wrote 1,005 songs, if I'm not mistaken. And we only have one, the Song of Solomon, the Song of Songs. One other thing. It says in that verse 42, it says, thus the time that Solomon reigned in Jerusalem over Israel was 40 years. And we're not told exactly how old he was when he died, but here's why I don't put a lot of credence in what Josephus said, because Josephus had said that so Solomon died when he was already an old man, having reigned 80 years and lived 94. Well, that's not right. I mean, he may have lived to be 94, but he didn't reign for 80 years. He reigned for 40 years, unless he was including, you know, maybe he reigned as a figurehead or something like that. But if Solomon died at 94, he lived quite of an old age. But I get the impression, more than the impression, that he probably died in his 80s. Anyway, anybody want to add or share to that chapter? Okay, well, listen, let's just quickly read this chapter 12. It's easy reading, and then we'll go ahead and close tonight. And this chapter 12, it says, then Rehoboam went to Shechem after all of Israel had come to Shechem to make him king. Now it came about when Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, heard of it that he was yet in Egypt when he had fled from the presence of the king Solomon while he was living in Egypt. They sent and called him, and Jeroboam and all of the assembly of Israel came and spoke to Rehoboam, saying, your father made your yoke hard, therefore lighten the hard service of your father and his heavy yoke which he has put on us, and we will serve you. Then he said to them, depart for 3 days, then return to me. So the people departed, and King Rehoboam consulted with the elders who had served his father Solomon, and while he was still alive, saying, how do you counsel me to answer this people? And they spoke to him, saying, if you will be a servant to this people today, will serve them, grant them their petition, and speak good words to them, they will be your servants forever. But he forsook the counsel of his elders, which they had given to him, and he consulted with the young men who grew up with him and served him. So he said to them, what counsel do you give that we may answer this people who have spoken to me, saying, lighten the yoke which your father put upon us? And the young man who grew up with him spoke to him, saying, thus you shall say to this people who spoke to you, saying, your father made our yoke heavy. Now you make it lighter for us. But
you shall speak to them, my little finger is thicker than my father's loins. Whereas my father loaded you with a heavy yoke, I will add to your yoke. My father disciplined you with whips, but I will discipline you with scorpions. Then Jeroboam and all of the people came to Rehoboam on the third day, as the king had directed, saying, return to me on the third day. And the king answered the people harshly, for he forsook the advice of the elders which they had given him. And he spoke to them according to the advice of the young man, saying, my father made your yoke heavy, but I will add to your yoke. My father disciplined you with whips, but I will discipline you with scorpions. So the king did not listen to the people, for it was a turn of events from the Lord, that he might establish his word, which the Lord spoke through Ahijah the Shilonite to Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. When all of Israel saw that the king did not listen to them, and the people answered the king, saying, what portion do we have with David? We have no inheritance in the son of Jesse. To your tents, O Israel. Now look after your own house, David. So Israel departed to their tents. But as for the sons of Israel who lived in the cities of Judah, Rehoboam reigned over them. Then King Rehoboam sent a Doram who was over the forced labor, and all of Israel stoned him to death. And the king Rehoboam made haste to mount his chariot to flee to Jerusalem. So Israel has been in rebellion against the house of David to this day. You know, now you get an idea of how this kingdom ends up splitting in two, splitting in half, because that's a very important part of history that we got to know exactly how this happened, how this split took place, because from here on out, we're just going to be reading about one king in the north and one king in the south, simultaneously, one after another, and it's interesting, if I'm not mistaken, all the kings that we're going to be reading about in the north, virtually none of them are good. And very few of the kings in the south are going to be good. And the standard for goodness, as far as God was concerned, was set by David. If they followed David's example, then God considered them to be a good king. And not too many of them did that. But that's how this kingdom split in half. And it was directly from the Lord. It was a direct punishment from the Lord. And you know what? I want to make this application, and I don't want to make too much of a mental leap here. But I would say this. This is what happened to the church. Because I am fed up with what I see today, when there are people who are forever flinging hash and flinging mud at each other when they're in these denominations. Because, in a sense, you could almost see it with these different tribes. We have all these different denominations today. But I believe that if you're on the right foundation and you have the essentials in terms of sound Christian doctrine, then you're still part of God's people. But as a judgment against Israel, this kingdom split. All right? But then he says... Well, you look at the situation, how it split. In other words, Rehoboam, he's the one that he forsook the counsel of his elders. They gave him the wise advice. They gave him the right advice. And, of course, he's just being young and dumb and stupid. He goes to his contemporaries, and they tell him what to say. And they just feel like, oh, man, don't let up on these people. Just tell them you're going to be twice as hard as your father was on them. And that was the end of it. That was the last straw. It just split the kingdom right in half. And the people said, the heck with you. And they just took off. And now they're going to make Jeroboam their king. Oh, I know one more thing before we move on, too. I get this impression that verse 18 says that then King Rehoboam sent Adoram, who was over the forced labor, and all of Israel stoned him to death, and the king Rehoboam made haste to mount his chariot to flee to Jerusalem. Now, I get this impression that, you know, they met there apparently in Shechem, and this is where Rehoboam said to the people, man, I'm going to make it really tough on you guys. You think my dad was bad, man, I'm going to use scorpions on you. And that's when it split. But it says here that because Rehoboam got in his chariot and took off, I got this impression that what happened was when all the people said, hey, man, forget you, we're out of here, we're leaving, and they all just started to forsake Rehoboam, I get this impression that he had second thoughts. He thought, oh, man, I made a mistake, I blew it. And he sent this Adoram, apparently he's a tax collector or he's somebody who's over the forced laborers, and he sent them, you know, to try to placate them, to try to say, okay, listen, you know, I made a mistake, come back, we'll renegotiate this whole thing. Well, instead, they just stoned him to death, right? And so what happens? Rehoboam, it says here, man, when he saw that happen, he just made haste. He got on his chariot, and he took off to Jerusalem. So, you see, this wasn't something that happened a long time after the fact. It happened right after he made this mistake. He thought, oh, man, I blew it. So he sends this guy after them, and they just stoned him to death. So, and it says, that's why in verse 19 it says, so Israel has been in rebellion against the house of David to this day. And in verse 20 it says, and it came about...
And John, David is of the tribe of Judah.
Right.
And that's what
right.
the southern tribe is going to become.
Right, exactly. And as a matter of fact, It's going to be the tribe of Judah and the tribe of Benjamin. They kind of assimilated in together. And, but there's still 10 tribes in the northern part that now are under the leadership of Jeroboam. And it says in verse 20, it came about when all of Israel had heard that Jeroboam had returned, that they sent and called him to the assembly and made him king over all of Israel. And none but the tribe of Judah followed the house of David. Now, like I said, it says none but the house of Judah. Well, when they talk about the house of Judah, a lot of times they just automatically incorporate the tribe of Benjamin in that. And in verse 21 it says, and when Rehoboam had come to Jerusalem, he assembled all the house of Judah and the tribe of Benjamin, 180,000 chosen men who were warriors, to fight against the house of Israel to restore the kingdom to Rehoboam, the son of Solomon. But the word of God came to Shemaiah, the man of God, saying, speak to Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, king of Judah, and all of the house of Judah and Benjamin, and to the rest of the people, saying, thus says the Lord, you must not go up and fight against your relatives, the sons of Israel. Return every man to his house, for this thing has come from me. So they listened to the word of the Lord, and they returned and went their way according to the word of the Lord. Then Jeroboam built the Shechem in the hill country of Ephraim and lived there. And he went out from there and built the Peniel. And Jeroboam said in his heart, now the kingdom will return to the house of David. Now really listen intently to what happens here, because this is very significant. Jeroboam, he has the northern kingdom. This is his reasoning in his heart. This is very, I think, insightful and enlightening, because in verse 27, this is what the guy says to himself. He says, if this people go up to offer sacrifices at the house of the Lord at Jerusalem, then the heart of this people will return to their Lord, even to Rehoboam, the king of Judah, and they will kill me and return to Rehoboam, the king of Judah. So the king consulted and made two golden calves, and he said to them, is it too much for you to go up to Jerusalem? Behold your gods, O Israel, that brought you up out of the land of Egypt. And he set one in Bethel, and another he put in Dan. Now this thing became a sin, for the people went to worship before the one as far as Dan. And he made houses on high places, and made priests from among all the people who were not of the sons of Levi. And Jeroboam instituted a feast in the eighth month, on the 15th day of the month, like the feast which was in Judah. And he went up to the altar, and thus he did in Bethel, sacrificing to the calves which he had made. And he stationed in Bethel the priest of the high places which he had made. And then he went up to the altar which he had made in Bethel, and on the 15th day in the 8th month, even in the month for which he had devised in his own heart, and he instituted a feast for the sons of Israel, and went up to the altar to burn incense. Now, this Jeroboam is thinking to himself, oh man, God requires everybody to go down three times a year to Jerusalem, where his temple is, to sacrifice down there, because they were not allowed to offer sacrifices anywhere else. But he just thought in his heart, if people start doing that, then eventually they're going to want to become one again with the southern tribes. And then they're going to have me executed, and that'll be the end of me. So he thinks, you know what I'll do? I'll make it really convenient for people. Instead of having people will have to go all the way down here to Jerusalem to worship three times a year, I'll put a temple up here in Dan, which is on the very northern part of Israel. And he's also going to put one down here in Bethel, which is kind of makes it really convenient. Convenient for the people. They're not going to have to go all the way down, make that trek three times a year down to offer sacrifice to the Lord. So see how convenient it is making it for people? And there's something else, a little bit of insight that I got from Josephus writing. He said, this is what Jeroboam says, I suppose, my countrymen, that you know this, that every place has God in it. Now, is that true or not? You know, look at the reasoning he's using here. We don't read this in the Bible. I'm just reading out of Josephus, but you get a little insight of what the guy was reasoning. And what he says is true. But look at how it could become such a snare to people. He says, I suppose, my countrymen, that you know this, that every place hath God in it. Nor is there any one place, a determinate place, in which he is. But he is everywhere, hears and sees those that worship him. Now, that's true, right? He says, on which I count, I do not think it right for you to go so long a journey to Jerusalem, which is an enemy city, to worship him. It was a man that built the temple, and I have also two golden heifers dedicated to the same God. He's saying it's the same God. It's a calf to represent the same God down in Jerusalem. Okay, that's important that we realize this. And one of them I have consecrated in the city of Bethel, and the other in Dan, to the end that those of you that dwell nearest these cities may go to them and worship God there. And I will ordain for you certain priests and Levites from among yourselves, that you may have no
want of the tribe of Levi. And then he just goes on and says that Josephus said that Jehoboam had said this. He deluded the people and made them revolt from the worship of their forefathers and to transgress their laws. This was the beginning of the miseries to the Hebrews and the cause why they were overcome by war and foreigners, etc., etc. Now, look at his reasoning. He says, well, he basically is saying this. Well, look, everybody, God's everywhere. He's not just one little place. He's everywhere. So I'm going to build a place here and a place over here to make it convenient for you, right? But it was a direct violation, just complete direct violation of what God had commanded, that they would only go to that one place and worship the one God. But they were insisting they were worshiping the one true God. But you know what? Nothing's changed. Remember what Paul says in 2 Corinthians chapter 11 when he was dealing with the Corinthians? He said this to them. He says, "For I am jealous for you with a godly jealousy, for I betrothed you to one husband, that to Christ I might present you as a pure virgin. But I am afraid, lest as the serpent deceived Eve by his craftiness, your mind should be led astray from the simplicity and the purity to devotion to Christ. For if one comes and preaches another Jesus..." Now, isn't this another Jesus in the Old Testament, so to speak? Another God, right? "For if one comes and preaches another Jesus whom we have not preached, or you receive a different spirit which you have not received, or a different gospel which you have not accepted, you bear this beautifully." How many people do that today? And he says something that these people that do this, they're false prophets, they're false teachers. He says they're deceitful workers disguising themselves as apostles of Christ. And he goes on to say, and no wonder, because even Satan disguises himself as an angel of light. And Paul tells us in Galatians chapter 1, he said this, which is, I think, goes right along with what we're reading tonight. He says, "I am amazed that you are so quickly deserting him who called you by the grace of Christ for a different gospel." Isn't this a different gospel, basically, that Jehoboam is introducing? I mean, even though it's the Old Testament, it's a different gospel. He says this. He says, "I am amazed that you are so quickly deserting him who called you by the grace of Christ for a different gospel, which is really not another. Only there are some who are disturbing you and want to distort the gospel of Christ. But even though we or an angel from heaven should preach to you a gospel contrary to which we have preached to you, let him be accursed. As we have said before, so I say again, now if any man is preaching to you a gospel contrary to that which you have received, let him be accursed." I mean, that's pretty strong, isn't it? That's what Paul is saying. And that's exactly what's happened to these people in the Old Testament. They got away from what God is strictly commanded them to do, and they said, "Well, it's the same God. We're just worshiping the same God." But you see what happened? It became a different God. Same thing that happens today within the church. People are preaching or believing in a different gospel, a different spirit, a different Christ. There's a cult of Christ where they deny his deity. That's a different Christ. And there's the Christ of materialism, the health, wealth, and prosperity group, you know, that God wants to bless you and prosper you and give you good health and you never have any problems or whatever. That's a different Christ. That's a different gospel, right? There's a central Christ. The homosexuals say, "Well, we have a church and we worship the one true God." But that's a different Christ. That's the essential Christ, right? I mean, there's all kinds of different Christ. And Paul saying this, I'm telling you right now, let that person be accursed if they are preaching a different gospel, a different Christ. And that's exactly what Jeroboam was doing, right? And the guy, what does it show? A total lack of faith, because God told him, "I'm going to give you this kingdom." Now, if he had his faith in God, he would have said what?
Ain't nothing that anybody's going to do to change that. God said he was going to give it to me.
Nothing's going to change that. I don't have to push and force and shove and manipulate this whole situation to secure my throne. God gave it to me, so I'm going to go down there along with everybody else and worship the one true God at the one place that he has chosen, and we're going to do it his way. But no, how many times do people just make a mess of their lives because they won't do it God's way? They figure, hey man, this seems a lot more reasonable. And, of course, the people went along with it because why? It was a lot more convenient. But it was a different gospel altogether. Now, I'm using the word gospel, but, you know, you understand it's the Old Testament. But it's the same parallel, the same thing. People in the Old Testament got deceived. They were worshiping this golden calf. But the golden calf, believe me, they didn't say, "Well, this is a totally new God." They just said that this is the image of the God that brought you out of Egypt. We're worshiping that God. But it really wasn't a god. It became a snare to them. And they end up inculcating all kinds of pagan practices into their worship. And it just brought one misery after another upon them in judgment. Because, you know, they basically were forsaking the one true God. Anybody have anyone to add or share? Because next week when we get into this, you know, I hate to break it up here, but I think this story gets pretty insightful. I mean, it gets pretty dramatic as far as the, what God does to this king. But I think the message is pretty solemn, that God is a jealous God. And, you know, when we forsake him, he's just going to bring judgment. And look, we just see it today when we got so many politicians that have more fear of men than the fear of God. That's exactly what Joel Bowen was. He had more fear of men than God. And look at the mess he made of his nation.